Doesn't matter whether it's England, America, Italy, Japan. Doesn't matter. You get a bird up there pulling her knickers down, and it's something they all understand.
Well, it's logical, isn't it? I mean, which would you rather see? An arty, crafty film or a bloody great pair of tits?
Hello, and welcome back to the Reprobate Podcast. My name's David Flint. Today I'm talking to David Miguelovray, screenwriter and author, and long-time anti-censorship campaigner. David's responsible for films as varied as House of Whipcord, Satan's Slave, Frightmare, and Trouser Bar. He's also written Doing Rude Things, The Definitive Study of British Sex Films, and his own rather scandalous autobiography. So let's get started. David, how are you?
Well, I'm okay, I suppose, really. I mean, it's very nice to talk to you, so I'm in quite a good mood today. But, you know, if you would ask me tomorrow, I might be doing nothing in particular and bored and worried about the future, and I'd be in a completely different mood. But then, you know, we're all in the same boat, as people keep saying. And it's just another cliche. The trouble is that everything has been said about this crisis over and over again. It's tremendously difficult to find anything else new to say. So let's hope we manage it, eh?
I think so. How's your lockdown been?
Well, it was a novelty to begin with. I remember watching our dear leader's address to the nation, and he said, you've got to stay indoors for 3 weeks. And I wrote in my diary that night, 3 weeks, how will I ever manage it? But the first 3 weeks were, you know, quite fun because it was new and different. But are we now talking, it's getting on for 3 months, isn't it?
It must be. I mean, I'd stopped counting. I think we started a week before people for various reasons, and I got to week 12 and then I stopped counting.
Yes, one day is very much like another, isn't it? And so weekends blur into weekdays, and which end is up, you know? Basically, yes, I've had enough, but I try and remain positive.
Well, it feels almost as though the whole lockdown is just collapsing in on itself anyway, for one reason or another.
I can vouch for that, because social distancing seems to be a thing of the past, at least where I live. But the parks are crawling with people who are not observing it anymore, and there seems to be no policing of it, whereas in the first couple of weeks, you know, we were watching TV and there were cops outside the stations saying, is your journey really necessary, sir? And that's all gone. And I was on public transport on Saturday, in fact, and you know, although masks are obligatory, well, not everyone was wearing one.
No, we were actually having this discussion earlier today. Just, you know, the bus driver is not really going to stop the bus and march up and down demanding people put a mask on, is he?
No, and there's get out clauses as well. If you've got asthma, then you're not required to wear one. So no one is going to dare go up to say somebody put your mask on and then get into an embarrassing situation. It appears to be unpoliceable, but I think people knew that to begin with.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one of those things that always depends on consensus, and I don't know whether it's that people get less scared because this time goes on, or whether they just become more complacent, but all the panic seems to go and they just want to get out, don't they?
It would appear so, yes. That time has passed. So we've got to get to a stage whereby there's general agreement that this has to stop, and we still have to maintain some kind of sense about the whole thing. Let's see if we can reach that balance.
Because this all happened, you were just about to launch a new project or start work, I guess, on your next film.
Well, of course, all work stopped almost overnight. I had two shows that were about to tour. They were cancelled immediately, along with my income. I now have virtually none. So all I can do is work on promoting a couple of projects, in fact. One is the film that I should have been shooting now, and the other one is this extraordinary project, Trouser Bar the Musical. I suppose that would need some explanation for people who haven't heard of Trouser Bar. But so I've got two projects that keep me semi-busy.
Well, now that you've brought Trouser Bar up, shall we discuss what Trouser Bar is, as you say, for those who might be unfamiliar with the phenomenon?
Shall we dismiss that first? Yes, well, they are linked, in fact, the musical and the film which you mentioned. So round about, I think it was 2015, I was getting into an enormous trouble with the John Gielgud Charitable Trust because they didn't want me to show a film, and we still can't talk about the reason why. Anyway, palms were greased, and the film did open at BFI South Bank here in London. I can't remember whether you were at that screening, were you?
I was.
You were? Okay, well, you'll remember perhaps that after the film, I was up on stage with others involved in the production. I think somebody said, "What are you doing next?" And I said, "I'm about to do something that'll make Trouser Bar look like," I probably said, "Watership Down." That's what I normally say. And that project, which was just in its infancy at that time, was a film of Robin Morm's novel, The Wrong People. So I thought that would get me into enormous trouble as well because of the theme of the novel. But we haven't as yet managed to put that into production, and there's no confirmation about when film production will begin again in this country. It's beginning to look extremely likely that it won't be this year now.
Really?
I'm afraid so.
I guess it's very hard to adhere to social distancing rules if you're making a film, no matter, you know, the best will in the world, certainly for something like your project.
Well, it's absolutely impossible, in fact. So you can't make normal films anymore unless you're Netflix and you can test the entire cast and crew, put them into quarantine before and after the shoot, and then you can have, you know, old school physical contact. There's a lot of that in our film, and it's going to be absolutely impossible to do unless you know, social distancing is relaxed. And it's looking increasingly likely that it won't be until quite late into next year. Already it looks as though there'll be no theatres open until next spring. So, you know, this is why occasionally I get a bit depressed.
Well, yeah, understandably. And then, you know, when we come out into this brave new world, will you be allowed to make films that have physical contact in any way? I mean, it seems that these kind of things are disapproved of more and more at the moment.
Absolutely true. Yes, it's impossible to know what the brave new world will look like. People are only theorizing. All I hope is that, you know, there's going to be no more isolation drama in which people in separate buildings look at the camera, because I can tell you right now, I've had enough of that, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's that point when you watch TV and every other commercial is just something for a bank where they've all filmed it from home looking very jolly and happy, and you think, oh, you know, surely somebody must have looked at this and thought, hang on, it's been done enough now. people don't need reminding that they can't go out.
Yes, I think so. I absolutely agree. After 3 months, yes, we've got the message. But yes, after, let's say, a year, are people going to be completely used to the new style of drama in which nobody touches each other? Now, there's a thing. Has anyone even discussed that possibility? You look at old films and TV programs in which there's, you know, a crowd of people in a room and they're shaking hands and kissing each other on the cheek, and it seems like another era, doesn't it? Already it seems so old-fashioned.
You've implied that your next film might, a bit like Trouser Bar, have a certain degree of, shall we say, physical contact between people. That seems to be disapproved of as well.
Yes, we're talking simulated sex, which yes, there will be a fair amount of that if we're allowed, and you know, as I say, who knows whether this is going to be allowed. Exciting times. I wish somebody would give us some guidance soon, please.
You think maybe we'll just have to look back on those shameful films of the 70s have recently been exposed as the height of filth or the depth of filth, however you want to look at it.
Well, of course, we're in a cleft stick because those are unacceptable as well. We're referring, of course, to an article in the Daily Mail in which a feminist disapproved of the fact that the likes of Confessions of a Window Cleaner was being offered on Amazon because, you know, surprise, surprise, films like this are crass and demeaning to women. Well, excuse me, I mean, I think we were aware of that while they were being made in the 1970s.
While
I was involved in the production of some of them. But of course, you know, the point is being missed completely because, as I've pointed out before, not only were women stereotypes, men were stereotypes as well, as were foreigners and homosexuals. Everybody was a ridiculous caricature. That was the point. That's British comedy for you.
Yeah, I mean, I guess even at the time, everybody involved in those things must have been aware that these are, as you say, stereotypes, they're cliches, they're exaggerations. It's not supposed to be a documentary.
No, far from it. And that was the spirit of not just British comedy, but farce the world over. You know, that's what farce thrives on, exaggeration. These are not real people. And now it's quite fascinating, as I've said in the latest edition of my book, Doing Rude Things, to look back and realize what we found funny in those days. Yes, okay, it's not funny now. Comedy doesn't tend to cross the generations. Very little comedy does. And it's quite interesting from an academic point of view to look back on what kinds of films were extremely popular. And there's no question about the fact that some of these films were.
Yeah, I mean, I guess comedy has to reflect the time it's made in, doesn't it? Because it is speaking to the audience that exists at that point.
Yes, and that's why it tends not to cross generations, you know. Generally, the only kind of comedy that does is silent comedy. So you know, that's why we still think that Buster Keaton is very funny. But he's a rarity, you know. Even the comedians who were popular at the time British sex comedy was popular, people like Morecambe and Wise, I mean, even they, eyebrows are being raised now about some of their comedy.
And it's also, it seems that comedy is one of those very national things, isn't it? You know, the British comedies didn't travel elsewhere. German sex comedies, French sex comedies, Italian sex comedies all just spoke to their own countries, by and large.
It's absolutely true, yes. We saw very little comedy from other countries in the UK. I can remember only a handful of examples on British TV when I was growing up, because we just didn't get their humour. I remember for some reason there was a Dutch comedian who got a British TV series. Don't ask me his name now, it's lost in the mists of time. But it was very strange by our standards. I don't think that series was recommissioned.
What do you make of the current situation of rather more recent comedies now being pulled from Netflix or from the BBC archives, or at least given assorted warnings before we see them?
Well, it was inevitable we were going to get onto this topic, of course. It's very current at the moment, and of course, well, I mean, I despair because, you know, generally speaking, we cannot censor our past. It's a pointless activity. So we're speaking specifically about Fawlty Towers, more recently Little Britain and the League of Gentlemen. I mean, again, everything has already been said. In each of those examples, the people concerned were not making fun of minorities. They were making fun of the people who make fun of minorities. Mm-hmm. And as I believe John Cleese said, if people can't see that, then why was the comedy commissioned in the first place? I think people are being immensely stupid in this respect. And I gather that this ban on Fawlty Towers has now been rescinded.
Yes, I think either they've edited it or they're giving contextual warnings, aren't they now?
Oh yes, we always need warnings, and some of them are going into overkill. There's a film called The Dam Busters, and you know what I'm going to say. The N-word is in it, and it's in it all the way through, because that was the name of the campaign. So you can't edit it out. But they haven't been able to ban the film. So when it's still shown on television with a warning at the front. But a friend of mine told me that it was shown at some august cinema, probably BFI South Bank. So there was an enormous introduction just about the fact that, you know, attitudes have changed. A word will be used in this film. And, you know, then there was an expert who came on and explained the context. And my friend said that by the time, you know, the word turned up for the first time, I'm afraid there was laughter. And, you know, that surely was not the intention.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you can possibly just give people a little heads up saying, by the way, this film was made at this point, set at this period of time when people said things that we wouldn't say now.
But aren't we all so aware of that now? Is there none of us who don't know this? You know, if you're interested in watching old films, and a lot that I've never seen are turning up on a channel called Talking Pictures, it is a bit of a worry that words are being dropped from the soundtrack. I mean, not only is there a warning at the front
of everything they show, you
know, virtually, of course. But then the most extraordinary words are being dropped for no real reason. I don't know whether we're allowed to use the word Japs on this podcast, but you certainly aren't on Talking Pictures, it seems.
Really?
It's true.
I only see little bits of Talking Pictures here and there. I do very much enjoy what they're doing, but I notice that they are quite censorial before a certain time. Even if the film they're showing is a 1960s movie that has a PG certificate, they'll still edit bits out.
Yes, they're I suppose as worried about everybody else as about losing their license, but they go to the most extraordinary extremes. A film, if I knew I was going to talk about this, I would have prepared, but I cannot remember what it is. But it was made around 1941. and Mervyn Johns goes into a bookshop, and there's a nudie magazine on the top shelf. You know, it would have been called a photo studies magazine in those days. And the front cover of the magazine is blurred. Was there any need?
I mean, I suppose they're just, as you say, they're very scared, aren't they? So they err on the side of caution because Ofcom can turn around and say, well, that's no longer acceptable at this time, even though they don't. I know because I've checked that they don't have a blanket ban on nudity before 9 p.m., but nobody would dare show it.
Now, you know more about the regulations than I do, and yes, I'm fascinated by this. Of course, I mean, because of my interest, lifelong interest in censorship and free speech. It's always going to be a talking point as far as the British are concerned.
I mean, free speech is one of those weird things now that whenever you say free speech, you get lumped in with the alt-right, it seems, whereas free speech, when I was growing up, I'm sure that when you were younger, free speech was very much a left-wing issue.
Definitely, yes, yes. Well, the times, they are a-changing, and that's how it should be. But back in the day, there wasn't the amount of confusion that there is now about what you can and can't say. And I think that this is the main trouble we're in now. You do not know if you can open your mouth or not, as far as, you know, the media is concerned. And this is all to do with some very vocal activists. And I think they have to give us some credit, because back in the day, things were much more straightforward. So obviously we've moved on because of the great liberation movements of the 1960s, and that is black people, women, and gay men and lesbians. But of course that was necessary, and everybody knew at that time who everybody was talking about and referring to. But now we're getting into an area that we've never got into before, and that is transphobia. And it's a hot potato because it's confusing. I'm not the only one I know who has had to learn new language. I mean, when I was young, everybody knew what a woman was. Everybody knew what a black person was. But now we're not sure about a non-binary person. We're not sure what a cisgender person is. Well, I mean, I'm learning gradually, but it's because of that we don't know who we're offending. And that's why you had the J.K. Rowling situation. She just didn't realize. So now we're in a position where we can't support a woman and a feminist because she, in quotes, is transphobic. And that is baffling for somebody of my age.
One of the situations that we have, obviously, is the constant reworking of terminology. So what was an acceptable phrase to use, say, 10 years ago, and even a supportive phrase to use, is now seen as essentially hate speech.
Oh, well, my goodness, yes, yes. And there was an example of that on television on Saturday, because they screened a documentary about James Baldwin called I Am Not Your Negro. And the word is in the film throughout, and on IMDb, somebody has counted the number of times that Negro is used. Why is that necessary? Because it's now hate speech. And it's extraordinary, because when I was growing up, it was a term of politeness. You didn't use the word black because that was offensive. And so we have gone from one extreme to the other. And that's fascinating, isn't it? How has that come about?
It's interesting because it's, you know, a cynical person might say that there are people out there just determined to rework things in order to trip particularly, say, older generations up, because it's very hard to keep up with. There was the famous case, I guess, a few years ago when, was it Benedict Cumberbatch referred to coloured people rather than saying people of colour? Because, you know, it's probably that was the polite phrase when he was growing up.
And yes, most certainly. And his class would have used coloured all the time. They never would have used the word black. And there's a reference to that in a Johnny Spate play, I think, called, I'm going to get this wrong, but it's something like, if blacks didn't exist, you'd have to invent them. And the use of black in the title of a television program in, and I'm guessing it would have been the early 60s, was tremendously shocking. Johnny Spate, who, as you know, wrote Till Death Us Do Part, was really pushing the boundaries there. Hard to explain that to kids now.
But the trans situation does seem to, particularly, as you say, it's the number one hot potato. And it's kind of interesting, I guess, from the point of view of somebody who's campaigned against censorship and in favour of, I say in favour of porn, for want of a better phrase, that I know suddenly that the radical feminists who were very much in favour of closing down any kind of sexually explicit material are now suddenly becoming the champions of free speech.
Yes, crazy times. How has it come about? I haven't analysed it. I can't give you the answer to this. Well, have you got one? I'll throw it back at you.
I have no idea. I mean, I think there's a certain degree of power play going on, in the sense that people want to either build careers or build reputations by being the loudest voice of the oppressed, even if they're not actually part of that group. And one good way of doing that, of course, is to trample on those who came before you. So, you know, you push them out of the way. It's very manipulative and very cynical in that way, I think.
I think you could be right. Yes, this is all about the shaming now, isn't it? Ultimately, does it all lead to economics? Is there money to be made out of this kind of shaming? Because it would account for everything. Can you, as you say, advance your career successfully if you adopt this kind of attitude? Can you sell more books? I must admit,
you could write books about it.
That too, yes. That could be a reason.
Yeah, and I think also lots of people genuinely seem to want to take on collective guilt for what previous generations have done. I mean, they need to atone. I'm sure that for a lot of people, that's a very genuine need. Whether it's the right thing to do or not is a different matter. But I'm not saying that people are not genuine in their beliefs in that kind of thing.
Well, you're talking essentially about white people's guilt here. And yes, it's eating us up at the moment. I mean, that's why we're talking about this. It is a concern. To me, you know, what can I say? I don't want to get into offence, because I think it's extremely important to offend people just to wake them up. But at the moment, and let's face it, it is mostly white people involved. It's mostly pulling down statues, let's face it. At least that's what it looked like on the video. So this is another issue as well, you know, trying to, forgive the term, whitewash the past in the hope that that will make us white people feel better.
But it's, you know, it's a sticking plaster, isn't it? It's just covering up something that you don't like the look of.
Of course it is, yes. I mean, unless you lived in Bristol, you would never have heard of this person. I know his name now, Colston. I didn't realize it was all over Bristol. You know, I played the Colston Hall, but I didn't know that's who he was. And so now his name is being removed from, well, I think it's already gone from Colston Hall. It's being removed from street names as well. But yes, is that the right way to go? I've got nothing against it. It seemed like a great day out to pull a statue down and chuck it in the river. I mean, that appeals to my sense of rebellion, of course. They looked, at least, as though they were all having a great day.
Yeah, I guess one aspect of this is, without wanting to try to belittle what might be genuine anger, I think the very fact that we've all been locked in for 3 months has certainly helped encourage people to want to get out and protest more.
Oh, dear, we're going... I never thought that this conversation... would be so controversial, Dave. We're getting into such sensitive areas here.
I thought we were just
going to talk about tits and bums. We can't stop now. We've got to go ahead. It occurred to me that there is a connection between the riots and the demonstrations that are happening all over the world. There's a connection between those and lockdown. There has to be, because it was a way of getting out of the house. Am I simplifying things here?
No, I think that makes perfect sense. I think also it's, you know, people will actually have very built-up frustrations and the tension of being locked in. So their emotions are probably heightened more as well.
I think so, yes. And I wondered where it was going to lead. I think it's relatively healthy, because if you read any science fiction novel about post-apocalyptic life, we're taught that it leads to looting. And that is the one thing that we haven't had. And there seems to be no desire to loot, not even in America. So instead, I mean, it seems like a rather jolly alternative, doesn't it, to go out and pull down a statue of apparently no artistic merit, dedicated to somebody you've never heard of, and push it in the water. What's wrong with that? I've got nothing against it at all, I have to say, but I wondered if it would lead on to more extreme forms of censorship, because, you know, now they're talking about all the statues that have to be removed.
This is where it gets slightly worrying, that they move on from to statues to books to films, as we're seeing. I mean, obviously I'm sure people will immediately be turning around and saying, well, of course they haven't banned these films or these TV shows, they've just removed them from certain platforms, but, you know, it's still an act of censorship.
Yes, which of course both of us have always been against, and that's why we're having this conversation. Yes, it's symbolic. It probably means nothing, but I suppose the first thing everybody said who is against censorship is, oh, are we going to start burning books next? Because a case can be made for that. There's a statue outside Broadcasting House in London, and it's by a sculptor called Eric Gill. And you probably know that he's now been, well, a long time ago, he was exposed as a paedophile. And there have been calls for that to be removed. Now, that is another matter, because it's a work of art. And if we're going to start destroying works of art, then what's the difference between us and the Taliban and what they did in Palmyra? Now, that's what we ought to be talking about.
No, I agree. I think it's that very difficult point. Where do you stop? Where do you draw the line?
And of course you can't, because if you've got that mindset, then you could sweep history clean, couldn't you? There would be statues to virtually nobody, including this conversation we had the day before yesterday. I said, well, what statues should we have instead of these old slave traders? Oh, I know, Eric Morecambe. Okay, his name's come up before in this conversation, and somebody pointed out then, no, there's a sketch that Morecambe and Wise did in which they're in the kitchen and making their breakfast in time to a piece of music. But I'm afraid that some of the activities they involve themselves in during that sketch are now racist. So, you know, let's, I don't want to go into what they are, but, you know, Eric Morecambe's statue in Morecambe is going to have to go.
It's
crazy times.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of interesting that I noticed that one of the films that Sky now have their warning on the front of was Aladdin from 2019, saying that this film contains outdated attitudes. Mm. It's like, it's from a year ago. You know, it's like, you know, we literally gone to year zero.
It feels like it sometimes, doesn't it? Just remind me, what's outdated in that version of Aladdin? I know there was trouble with the cartoon version and lyrics were rewritten.
I imagine it's much the same thing. I mean, it's Western filmmakers making a film about a culture that isn't their own. I don't know. To be fair, I haven't seen it, so it could have some wildly offensive stuff in.
I haven't either, but okay, I can imagine what it might be, yes.
But it's interesting because, of course, as you know, what was acceptable yesterday is not acceptable today, and vice versa. So, you know, all the people who are being very judgmental at the moment probably don't realize, because I guess, you know, this is the first time that they've had to deal with this kind of thing, that in 10 years' time, it could be them. It could be something they've said, some words they've used.
Yes. Haven't there been examples of that? You know, people who stand up and make proclamations. This is why I'm very careful not to do this kind of thing. and then they're hoist with their own petard because somebody mentions a tweet that they wrote 12 years ago.
I think that's the interesting thing. I mean, it's that whole point of, particularly now with social media, I guess, that you do need to have led a completely blameless life and never said anything wrong or dubious or made an off-color joke, because you can't then turn around and take the moral high ground. There'll be somebody who will, from either side of the political spectrum, somebody will then go through everything you've ever said, and they do seem to have infinite amounts of time to do this, looking for that one statement. It's probably better just to be wildly offensive all the time. And
I think so. Yes. It's all out there. If you haven't removed it, then it's there for everyone to see. And if you're a politician, yes, your entire history has to be as pure as the driven snow, without a doubt. I try not to make political statements. I mean, this is a turn up for me, I tell you, because who knows what, if indeed anyone is listening, who knows what people are going to challenge me with, something that I've forgotten I said or wrote 20 years ago, which now contradicts what I'm saying right this minute. I have to say, you know, my conscience is, as far as I'm aware, clear. You know, I don't think I've said anything racist, sexist, or homophobic in my entire life. Now, how about that for a statement? Do you want to now, whoever you are, go online and prove me wrong?
Well, I suppose the other point as well with you is that your life, particularly now that you have your autobiography out, is an open book. You've confessed to all sorts of disgraceful behaviour. So, you know, how can you be shamed?
It was a ploy of mine. Yes, I thought I'll say everything myself and then nobody can throw anything at me. We're talking about a book called Little Did You Know. Let's get a plug in for it.
Of course,
it was it was a wonderful experience to set it all down in print and come clean, although perhaps that's not the right word. Yes. I recommend it to everyone. It's a very freeing experience, because I was terribly uptight about everything when I was a boy. I didn't want anyone to know anything for various reasons. But the sense of liberation, I can't speak highly enough about it.
And I guess if you expose yourself, nobody else can expose you, can they?
Yeah, Yeah, and you can tell what you think is the truth. And, you know, I didn't want to die and then for somebody to get it all wrong and tell lies about me. I thought, I'll tell the truth now, because it's so apparent to me that if you spend your life covering something up, that the minute you die, it will be revealed, and then that's all people will remember you for. So, yeah. I mean, there's so many examples of this, but the best of all for me is Edgar Hoover, you know, who's, you know what I'm going to say, but he spent all his adult life as the head of the FBI. Now, does anyone remember that now? As soon as you see Edgar Hoover come up on your screen, you think, oh, transvestite.
Well, he was just ahead of the curve.
Well, you know, far from it, because he was so closeted, and now everybody knows that. So the whole thing was completely pointless. He could have come out, so to speak, at the beginning of his FBI career and said, I love dressing up in women's clothes. And everyone would have said, oh, Edgar, marvelous. Well, they wouldn't, perhaps, in those days. It was probably illegal in the States. But how sad, you know, that people spend their lives covering something up and then everything goes from one extreme to the other after they die. So I didn't want that, no.
No, well, that's good. But let's talk about Trouser Bar for a minute. I'm intrigued by Trouser Bar the musical, and I'll add in, when I post this podcast, I'll add links to the book and to Trouser Bar so people can familiarize themselves with your work. But Trouser Bar the musical, how's this possibly going to work?
Well, how kind of you to mention it. Well, is it going to work? We've no idea, because nobody knows when theatres will reopen, and that's the end of that. However, I made a short film, a silent film called Trouser Bar, and it went all over the world, and I had great fun introducing it in other countries, and that lasted for about a year. That was a wonderful year, and then I thought, oh well, that's the end of that. Last summer I was at a garden party, and the man opposite me at the table said, oh, Trouser Bar, how about making it into a musical? And I loved the idea straight away. He's a composer. I thought I'd never hear anything about it again, but exactly a year later we have a lyricist and a director, and we've just got the first draft of the book, and I love it. It's great. I'm in it as a character. It's not just Trouser Bar the musical, of course, because that was a 20-minute film, but this is a musical about how that film came to be made, and it's a tribute to Peter de Rome, the pioneer erotic filmmaker who should have made Trouser Bar, but I couldn't persuade him, and then he died, and so I thought, well, I'll make it myself. And that's the story of that. Who would have thought that that would come up? That was a delightful surprise.
That makes a lot more sense. I was just wondering how you could stretch that 20 minutes of naked men having sex, yes, into a theatrical performance. I mean, I'm sure you could if you put your mind to it.
No, you couldn't, in all honesty, Dave. No, that would have been impossible. So we've got a long, long build-up. It's like the foreplay, really. And then part of Trouser Bar is staged live. And it'll be a production number, you know, there'll be people singing and dancing, so I can't wait to see that.
Neither can I. That sounds extraordinary.
Well, I'll see you there. If we can get it on stage, who knows?
Well, as you say, I mean, if the theatres are staying closed until next year, and I guess lots of places are still in that limbo situation, so we don't even know how many places will still be around, do we?
How true, yes. Already some theatres have gone into liquidation. They're not reopening. You know, what will regional theatre be like? I've no idea, because a lot more will never reopen. And it's hard to imagine, if social distancing stays in place, how any theatre could ever reopen, because some people have done the feasibility study, and if they have to take out seats, which they are doing in Germany, I gather, they will play to half-empty houses at every performance, and they cannot break even. There's just no way. So the only way they can do it is with government subsidy. Now, you know, you know what the government's like with arts funding. Are they really going to make a priority of giving theatres money when we have so many other things to worry about? It seems so unlikely, which is, again, depressing.
I mean, it does seem that once things get back to whatever the new normal turns out to be, that, you know, we're gonna have this huge financial crash coming, because if governments, as they keep telling us, don't have that much money, and they've just been spending like crazy with this, so I guess we're gonna have to all pay back in one way or another.
Yes, where is the money coming from? We're in, what is it, more debt now than we've ever been since the 1960s? I mean, you never know what to believe, because nobody knows anything, and we are still being fed a lot of lies. But yes, I don't know how we're going to get out of that debt. I presume we're going to have to borrow even more money from China.
Yes.
Is that going to work out? I don't know.
And that's assuming that, of course, you know, we don't get a second wave.
Well, that's the next thing to discuss, isn't it? Yes.
But I guess if we can take something as a little side benefit of all the protests, is that if we don't have a huge resurgence in the next week or two, then we know that it really is diminishing, because obviously people haven't been social distancing, they've been out together, they've been breaking all the rules. So if we don't have an upheaval, then I guess then coronavirus really is on the way out.
Yes, that is how it's looking. Yes, we'll know very, very soon. And if we can learn from history, then that seems to have been what happened with so-called Spanish flu 100 years ago. The second wave was worse than the first, but that was because, apparently, Armistice Day came along, everybody went out onto the streets, they were hugging and kissing, the pubs were full, and then they started getting sick 2 weeks later. So there's no question about why that happened. Now, is that going to happen again this time? Time will tell.
How are you finding this new way of working?
Well, it's no substitute, is it? But now we all have to adapt. Like everyone, I'd never heard of Zoom 3 months ago. Now I'm on it every day. And we had a script reading of my screenplay for The Wrong People on Zoom with a cast of 15. But I would have done more research had I known, because, you know, unless everybody's got the right internet connection and perfect lighting and Dolby sound, the results are not good. And it's an imperfect technology at the moment. I mean, it's quite exciting to be to be part of it in the early days, really. I'm sure we'll tell our grandchildren, oh yes, I remember Zoom, yes, the pictures used to freeze, and then you couldn't hear what people were saying because they all spoke at once. It'll be a joke. So it's quite an honor to be part of this, but, you know, I personally, I would still rather be round a pub table with real people, and I'm sure you would too.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I think, you know, I'm quite missing pubs, and I'm looking at the idea of pubs opening, and part of me is really keen for it to happen, and the other part is thinking, will it be like, and what will people be like? You know, will there be people running around licking everything and touching everything and being horribly infectious, or will we all have to sit in these little bubbles? And I'm just not sure how much it's appealing to me at the moment.
Well, under those circumstances, nobody would go to a pub. Bookshops have opened, and apparently if you take a book off the shelf, I mean, again, you've probably heard this, I'm not telling you anything, but if you take a book off the shelf, you can't put it back again. You have to put it in a separate pile because it has to be sanitized. Now, are people going to go to bookshops under these circumstances? Again, time will tell. Will people go to pubs if they can only go in the beer garden and sit with their two friends at one table, 2 meters from other friends? Can that work? I bet they're trying to work out if it can.
Oh, I think lots of them are looking at different ways of doing it, but haven't seen anything that sounds really realistic in terms of social engagement. I mean, it's interesting that you were saying about bookshops, because I think it's also that thing of getting people used to new habits, because I know that we went to buy some food in M&S last week, and you'll pick a packet of something up and look at it and then just put it back down as you would normally, and then later on you're thinking, hang on, was that a bad thing to do?
I know, is this allowed? There's no signs telling you that you can't do this, so is this something that people, the authorities, have forgotten, you know? And if it is, then maybe we should address ourselves to that. You know, if you can't pick something up and put it back again.
Yes, it's all very strange. Who knows where we'll all end up.
Knows. No, nobody knows. But I try to remain optimistic. That's all I can say.
Well, good. Well, on that note, let's wind this up on a positive note. You know, we've got a bright future to look forward to, and we can all sit there in the pub in 6 months' time laughing about this, I'm sure.
I'll enjoy meeting you in the pub, Dave. It's been a great pleasure talking to you today.
Thank you very much, and I'll speak to you soon.